You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the issue of the 5th to the 11th of November. I'm Chris Havergal and I'm joined by reporters David Matthews, Jack Grove and Matthew Rice. This week, the government has been accused of outrageous interference in university autonomy by leaning on an institution to remove a controversial governor from its board. David has the details on that. Why are black and minority ethnic staff so heavily underrepresented in the top echelons of our universities? Jack had exclusive access to the latest data from the Equality Challenge Unit for this week's cover feature. And in one of our more gruesome features for a while, Matthew has been exploring the work of academics on body farms in the United States. But first, details have emerged of how the government pressured London Metropolitan University to remove a governor from its board, triggering accusations of unprecedented encroachment on university autonomy. David, this story goes back to 2013 when London Met was fighting for the return of its visa sponsorship licence.
That's right, yeah. Readers might remember that period. Basically, London Met had been stripped of its licence to sponsor international students following what the government said was, you know, poor record keeping, that kind of thing. Didn't seem related at the time, but there was another series of stories about the suspension of a guy called Jawad Botmah, who he was found guilty in 1996 of conspiracy to cause two explosions outside the Israeli embassy in London. And he went to prison, although he always maintained his innocence, and there are some that raise questions of his conviction. Anyway, in January 2013, he had been working at London Met as a research manager. But in January 2013, he was elected a staff governor. The following month, he and one of the Unison leaders there, Max Watson, was suspended. So Mr. Botman was suspended over his conviction, and Max Watson was suspended over the his role in appointing him. And then following, there was a bit of protest over this, and then the university says, okay, we've looked into it, and the suspension is lifted, he can be a governor. And at the time, we thought that was that. That seemed to be the end of the matter. But we've discovered minutes from London Met's website, which basically show what happened in the very first governor's board meeting where Mr. Botman was present as a governor. And what these essentially show is that the UK, London Met had received feedback from the UK border agency essentially about Mr. Botman serving as a governor. And what they said is, if he remains a governor, will we not approve the new application for a Tier 4 licence for international students, but we'll also remove the existing Tier 2 licence, which allows a university to recruit staff from outside the EU. In the minutes they discussed this, this would essentially be bankrupting for the institution because, you know, the financial plans are based on, you know, having a certain number of international students, which is the case for most universities. So there was discussion over this, and eventually Mr. Botman agreed to resign with immediate effect, and then they got the licence back. I mean, this is, as far as I can tell, I've not heard of another incident of this happening where the government, or in this case the UKBA, which was then scrapped, taken back into the Home Office, of actually pressuring universities to remove a governor. And the UCU are very unhappy about this.
I mean, this is to do with institutional autonomy, presumably, and the freedom for, you know, institutions to have people on, you know, their boards who they wish, you know, particularly in this case where it was someone who was actually elected by staff.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what the UCU at London Met would say, you know, that this is the basic government interference in, is entirely within their rights to elect him. He, you know, served his sentence and so on. When we contacted the Home Office, they basically draw our attention to guidance, which says that the one of the things that they can take into account is who is director i.e. who is a governor on a university. So taking this prior conviction into account is certainly within the guidance. I don't think that there's any suggestions they've acted outside their powers. But I think the question is whether they've, you know, whether it's right to say this person has committed this crime, convicted this crime, they shouldn't be on that board.
Sure. And what does Land and Met have to say about this?
Well, they said their line was very much that it was absolutely right for them to act in accordance with UKBA guidance. I suppose, you know, some people might wonder whether they should have stood up to UKBA a bit more, said, no, we defend our... But actually, you know, when you're faced with that kind of existential threat to the university, I'm sure that many people would say they had no choice.
Indeed.
It does raise some rather interesting questions about the initial suspension of Tier 4 licensing and getting it back, because I covered that story back in 2012 and it was all about, you know, not having checks and balances to ensure that students were up to scratch and attending lectures. If you're then throwing suddenly into the mix a governor and some unspent conviction, I mean, I don't really see what's that got to do with the price of anything really.
It's complicated stuff. Well, you can read all about that on pages 6 and 7 of this week's magazine. Mr. Jack, we now turn for this week's cover feature. While the number of black and minority ethnic people employed by UK universities has increased significantly in recent years, the most senior jobs remain beyond the reach of most. Jack, you've been looking at the latest data from the Equality Challenge Unit for this piece. What did you find?
Yes, well, this is the big set-piece publication from the Equality Challenge Unit. They're the people behind Athena Swan, and they're also extending that sort of initiative out into a race equality charter mark. And so actually I've been looking at the issue of race and the numbers of black and ethnic minority staff. I suppose this all has sort of been in the news quite recently regarding the arguments regarding why isn't my professor black. And this is a sort of theme that I sort of look at in a bit more detail, looking at using the figures, and there's a real sense that there doesn't seem to be a shortage of black and ethnic minority students, and around half of them are doing STEM subjects, but they don't seem to be progressing for one reason or another into postgraduate study in the same numbers, or then to PhD studies, and then there's a very high dropout rate at PhD studies, and then some of the black academics I'd spoken to said that they felt they were discriminated against, or whether indirectly or directly, and that had sort of limited and blocked their promotion opportunities. So I'm just sort of exploring this issue and looking at the figures behind it.
It seems that almost at every step of the way, as you move through academia from being an undergraduate to being a postgraduate to being a member of staff and then rising up to the very highest points, there just seems to be a sort of a filter at every level where black and minority ethnic staff and indeed students become, you know, less and less represented.
Well, this is a criticism that's made, and some people would claim it's because the university hierarchy is very white dominated, and they want to sort of reproduce and sort of replace. When they take on someone else, they want to sort of reproduce in their own image. So they don't really look at people who don't look the same or have the same sort of political or social values as them or background. And so many black academics feel sort of quite excluded from that whole sort of power nexus at the top of universities. And I've been speaking to them about that.
It's a very interesting feature. I mean, it's really extraordinary. I mean, Baroness Amos taking over the reins at SOAS seems to be the first, you know, the UK's first ever black vice chancellor. It seems extraordinary. And you make the point of that there's only three black or minority ethnic vice chancellors in the UK, but none of them have come kind of through the sort of traditional, you know, working your way up through the university system. They've all come from outside, you know, other countries' academies. So there's not. But I did just wonder whether probably not all of this could be explained, but maybe some of it is just by the kind of demographic structure of the UK. In the older the age group in the UK, the more white it tends to be, just for the because of the sort of historical patterns of immigration to the UK.
Well, possibly, but there is something in that. But the people I spoke to say, well, women, for instance, women. There was lots of women students, but they weren't really making it to the top of the tree until some real focused, targeted activity to sort of promote them and help their careers was put into practice. And they say that the same is true of UK universities with black staff. They need help and support and encouragement, and universities really need to sort of look at themselves and see, you know, are they sort of supporting these academics in the way that they could be doing so.
And it's not just ethnicity that this report looks at. It also looks at gender and some sort of striking figures also on gender and the gender pay gap, if I understand rightly, Jack.
Yeah, that's another chapter which is quite interesting. I mean, I don't think the implication is that a junior lecturer who's male is paid more than a woman lecturer of the same grade, but because of these inequalities in the fact that there's more highly paid women, male professors, women are more likely to work part-time, they're more likely to be on a teaching-only contract, they're more likely there's a whole range of indicators which mean that these inequalities fuel a sort of gender pay gap that is an average of over £6,000 a year in salary, so that's quite significant, really.
Well, it sounds like there's going to be plenty to keep the Equality Challenge Unit busy in the years to come. That feature can be found on page 32 of this week's magazine. There's also more in the news section. Also this week, we have the latest on the plans for the government's green paper, now expected imminently. We explore data from the Great British Class Survey, which is billed as demonstrating a close link between being in the elite and attending an elite university. And we have the latest of our Times Higher Education World University Rankings subject rankings, this week covering the social sciences. But finally, Matthew, we like to chart the weird and wonderful tasks which academics find themselves in the course of their research. This must be one of the strangest yet, the body farm. You've been exploring what a body farm is at US universities. Perhaps you could just help by explaining what exactly one is.
Well, there are six body farms, so-called body farms, which exist in American universities. And they are basically places where the process of human decomposition is studied. And the people who work there claim, and they claim quite rightly, that this is very important research. If you want the date, the exact time of death is very, very important in murder investigations. So that if you know exactly how quickly a vulture can sort of pick apart a corpse, it can be very relevant information. And there are also cases where bodies which haven't been identified, it's very useful to know what happens to skeletons after death. You can find out, for example, if they were overweight or were in a wheelchair or something. So this is really genuinely very important information. But it is to most people, certainly to me, rather strange work. Both basically these bodies are just kind of put out in a field and left to decay. And then kind of you see what happens. And of course the other thing is, it also seems to be rather strange that people want to give their own bodies or the bodies of their loved ones to this sort of, even if they want to do good, to give it to a medical school or organ donation seems rather more obvious than just to be kind of picked apart by scavengers.
Indeed, if I understand rightly, for them to accept a body, there's no time for the family to hold a traditional sort of memorial service or funeral. It's much sort of swifter donation than that.
Yes, it has to be done very quickly, or you have to have some sort of memorial without the body.
obviously sort of important research, but what did you find in the course of writing and researching this feature about how the academics working at these facilities, and indeed how the students who are sort of involved in, you know, being taught around some of the science that comes out of this, how do they deal with working in that kind of environment?
Well, I think there is a kind of, for the students, there is a kind of desensitization process. I suppose it's not that different from being in a medical school, I guess. And the one of the women who I spoke to, directors of one of these facilities, said that she had one student, a really good student, who just couldn't deal with the smell. So that she could, there were some days in which she could do the work and other days she couldn't, basically. And so it is a process. What I also asked about was whether there wasn't something rather strange about, you know, people choosing to as it were, do this to the bodies of their loved ones. Isn't there something sort of unnatural? Because everywhere there's some sort of rituals around the dead. And they said, well, you know, you could make the opposite case that, you know, traditional funerals, they're very energy expensive. You fool corpses through with chemicals and so on. And that some people also like the idea of just being out there in the open air and slowly decaying. That part of America was a place they particularly attached to. So there is a case that there's, you know, the more traditional funerals, that there's something to be said against.
That's fascinating stuff. That can be found on page 42 of this week's magazine. And like all the stories we've been discussing today, can also be found online at timeshighereducation.com. If you'd like to join the conversation about any of our stories this week, you can find us on Twitter, on Facebook and on LinkedIn. But that's all for this week's podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.